two young women kissing in a lover's lane.
Strangled with nylon rope. And then while they're still alive, their throats are cut.
Oh my God, oh my God.
Four young couples brutally murdered.
I mean, everyone was killed differently. It's almost like there's an experiment going on.
Apparently, you can kill someone in Virginia and get away with it.
They're the most notorious serial killings in Virginia history.
There's one sick son of a gun out there, that's for sure.
And whoever's responsible could still be out there.
If they don't catch this person, how many other people are they gonna kill?
I'm M. William Phelps, investigative journalist, and I have an obsession. Serial killer, cold cases.
Now, nearly 10 years later, investigators say they still need the public's help.
For me, it's personal. My sister-in-law was murdered, and her killer has never been caught. These killers are still out there. Their victims deserve justice. And just one new clue could make all the difference. I don't have a badge, but I do have something the cops don't have. Someone who understands the dark mind of a murderer.
As I started killing again and again, I saw it as a purpose.
Because he is one. October 9, 1986. In Williamsburg, Virginia, 27-year-old naval officer Kathy Thomas prepares for the day.
What time's your exam? 11?
With her girlfriend, 21-year-old business major Becky Dowski.
Are you nervous?
I'm prepared.
Kathy only had two gay relationships, first with her shipmate, and then that girlfriend introduced Kathy to Rebecca Dowski.
You will be fine.
Kathy's brother Bill recalls the budding romance.
It was a new relationship and one that we knew Kathy was very excited about, and we were very excited about meeting Becky later on that fall.
But while Kathy's family accepts her sexuality, she keeps it a secret from most people.
They were very much on the down low. This was Virginia, the 1980s. It was not okay to be in the Navy and be gay or lesbian. So they were very, very discreet. It's amazing and kind of sad the way we made people live their lives back then.
To get a little privacy, some nights Kathy and Becky drive out to a secluded spot along the Colonial Parkway. It's a historic road that winds through scenic woodlands and waterways between Yorktown and Jamestown. October 9 is one of those evenings.
Kathy and Becky pulled over on the Colonial Parkway at this very pretty spot alongside the river on a pull-off, which is known as a lover's lane.
So who made the first move?
You.
I think there was a hand on a leg.
Oh,
something like this.
A young couple in the heady days of a new romance. Enjoying the rare chance to express their affections. Safe from judgment and prying eyes. At least they thought they were.
Someone approached the car and with a limited struggle seems to have overpowered the two women or perhaps separated the two women and ends up using a variety of techniques to kill them.
Three days later, a jogger finds Kathy's vehicle on the riverbank.
This is where it all starts. Colonial Parkway, York River. Shattered lives, an unsolved mystery. A car over the embankment. And a jogger just coming by.
The first cop on the scene thinks it's a traffic accident until he sees the horror inside.
Both women, Kathy and Becky, are strangled with nylon rope. And then while they're still alive, their throats are cut. and the two bodies are dumped in my sister's car. And there's a very clumsy attempt made with diesel fuel to set the car on fire. And then what they ended up doing was pushing the car over the embankment. A lot of experts have used the expression overkill. Here you have three different methods used. You've got the rope, the knives, and the attempt to set the car on fire.
There's no sign of robbery or sexual assault. So what was the motive? What kind of monster would butcher these two women, and why? I need to bring in someone who knows monsters. Criminal profiler, John Kelly.
The Dowski-Thomas scene, horrific. What does it tell us about our killer here?
When I look at it, it tells me he's inexperienced. He's new. He's just getting started. And he's trying to perfect his method of murder. Okay, this is what he's doing. Think about it. First, he strangles them. He's not sure if it's working. So to make sure, he cuts their throats. So he doesn't have enough confidence in himself. He's just getting started. And he's going to continue to kill. And he's going to refine his killing.
Is John Kelly right? Was the killer using Kathy and Becky for practice? I want to get a second opinion from the mouth of a killer. It's time to fetch Raven from his cage.
Okay, Raven. The Dowski-Thomas crime scene. It was really messy. Talk to me about that.
I think this is the first time they killed because it is so messy. An inexperienced kill would neither be an overkill. A lot of people think that murder has to be really violent, and therefore they go at it viciously to make sure that the end result happens.
Raven's on board with Kelly's theory. The brutality points to a novice. But what about the attempt to burn the bodies?
I think that's more of a point that, you know, it's personal. Any time where someone has tried to burn a body or whatever, it's because they see the person.
Do you think the killer knew Dowski or Thomas?
I think they knew both of them.
Boom. A crime of passion. It would explain both the violence and the attempt to hide the evidence. In one way, you could say Raven's just playing the averages here. Over 75% of murder victims know their killer. But Kelly thinks there's more to it.
When you look at what he had to go through, or what he decided to go through, to try and hide the bodies, I feel he either knew them or was connected to them in some way. He went through a lot of trouble. There's some kind of connection. He was known to them somehow. If he didn't know them, if there was no connection to him, why didn't he just leave them there and walk away from the car? Why's he got to take the vehicle, put them in the trunk, go through all this trouble to take it to an embankment, try to light it on fire, run it down an embankment, and run it into a river?
It's a strong point. And now I'm thinking, all that effort seems like the work of a guilty mind. Someone who not only knew one of those girls, but loved them. So, were Kathy and Becky's ex-lovers ever investigated?
My sister's first girlfriend was looked at as a suspect, actually quite seriously. She had introduced Kathy and Rebecca Dowski, was taking a class with Rebecca, was with the women on the last night of their lives.
But Kathy's ex is never charged. Becky's former partner is also looked at and cleared. More than 25 years later, the horrific murders remain unsolved. And all the families have left to hold on to are pictures.
She's beautiful.
Oh, thanks. This is one of those portraits from the Naval Academy. She really enjoyed her time there and was very proud of being in the Navy and serving the country.
I know the kind of pain Bill Thomas goes through every day. Because my sister-in-law's killer is still out there, too.
In 1986, Bill Thomas and his family's lives were devastated by the murder of Kathy Thomas. But what they didn't know was that Kathy's case was about to become part of something much, much bigger.
Shut up, stay there.
Young lovers Kathy Thomas and Becky Dowski are the first to be brutally murdered in a series of infamous double homicides known as the Colonial Parkway Murders. I'm driving the parkway now myself, on my way to meet a private investigator who knows these cases like the back of his hand. Steve Spingola, former FBI guy, got a lot of contacts in the FBI. He's worked these cases. He knows a lot. He's got some theories. Can't wait to hear what he has to say.
A mile and a half down, they found a car. And like I said, it was like one of these rust spots.
Spingola was hired by Bill Thomas to look into the murder of his sister, Kathy, and her girlfriend, Becky.
So what do you think happened, Steve?
Well, Miss Thomas had rope burns around her throat and wrists, indicating that at one point she was bound. Her throat had the deepest slash on the left side, going across to the right ear where the knife was pulled out, indicating the suspect was probably right-handed. There was a clump of hair in her left hand that was sent to the police department for DNA examination. We know from the autopsy the women were not sexually assaulted. It looks like they put up a struggle, but not a major fight. There weren't injuries to their knuckles other than the hair in the hand of Ms. Thomas.
To the cops' disappointment, DNA testing provides no match on the hair. And there's no other hard evidence that might identify the killer. The car was out in the elements for 3 days before it was found. That meant fingerprints or other trace evidence may have been lost.
There was also some diesel fuel that was dumped on the car in an attempt to ignite it, but diesel fuel does not ignite at a low temperature. In other words, from something like a match, you would need a source of ignition higher than a match or a lighter. Then the suspect attempted to dump the car, push the car over the embankment, but there was because of the heavy brush, it was hung up and not able to go into the river.
What are motives? What's on your mind for motives?
Well, I think part of the problem was, back in 86, was that their relationship was not as socially acceptable as it is today. And they were clearly lesbian lovers. I believe that the suspect saw them and was angered by their relationship. And again, when you look at the physical evidence there, the injuries to the throats, it's massive. This is just brutal.
A volcanic rage.
Absolute anger. All the way back on Miss Thomas's neck to the spine where it nicks the spine. Clearly, this is somebody that had pent-up rage inside of them. Whether the male that's done this, and I believe it's a male, has something against homosexual lovers, or there was just some type of incident in his life in which he became very angry, and he reaches out occasionally with extreme violence and kills people.
A hate crime? That's a crime of passion, all right. Like Raven said. But maybe this maniac didn't know his victims personally, after all.
One of the things that was looked at is that it may have been a park ranger who was out here. There was a number of complaints against a white male park ranger who had been stopping females and making inappropriate suggestions.
Other strange clues support the ranger theory. The driver's side window on Kathy's car was rolled down, and her driver's license wallet was out, as though she'd been asked for ID. But the park ranger in question is never charged. Then, FBI investigators float another theory. That it could be someone impersonating a ranger or some other kind of authority figure. A number of suspects are investigated, but no arrests are made. And then, almost a year later, in September 1987, 20-year-old David Nobling and 14-year-old Robin Edwards stop at a rest area, another lover's lane, along the James River. It's only 20 miles south of where Kathy and Becky were killed.
I think they went there to have some sort of a romantic interlude. Somebody walked up on the car. The windows rolled halfway down, like on the driver's side, as if he's talking to somebody. Again, there's been speculation it may have been somebody impersonating themselves as a police officer because of the way the windows rolled down.
They're marched into the woods at gunpoint. You can just imagine their terror. Waiting, wondering. Where is he taking us? Should we run or try to fight him? Is this the end of my life? David and Robin's bodies are found 3 days later, lying in the mud. Is this the same guy who killed Kathy and Becky?
Do you think these cases are connected?
Yeah, I definitely believe these cases were connected. I mean, you've got romance, you've got couples. I'm looking at them being in a pretty much out-of-the-way or secluded area.
Okay.
Being in a car. And I'm also looking at a serial killer with this jealous rage. He either can't have a relationship or he is in a relationship where his emotional needs are not being satisfied.
So when he spots somebody in a romantic setting, and maybe they're embracing, kissing, whatever, that rage just comes out of him.
Absolutely. He's so angry. He doesn't care if they're heterosexual. He doesn't care if they're homosexual. It's all about the passion.
He's driving down the parkway. It's at night. It's dark. He can see the reflection of the moon off the York River. And he spots a couple engaged in a kiss. What does he do?
At that point in time, he starts to really, really become excited. He's getting closer to his victims of choice. He's getting closer to destroying their lives, their romance, the relationship. If he can't have any type of emotional relationship with anyone, why should they? And he gets extremely excited because now he's closing in on the kill.
So now let's talk about what doesn't connect them. We have a method of murder in the first case here of slicing the neck and strangulation. And then we have this guy shooting. Do serial killers do that? Do they go from strangling and stabbing to using a handgun?
He's evolving. He's experimenting on human beings on how to kill them to find his most preferred method of murder.
Kelly's been a profiler for over 20 years, so the guy knows his stuff. Still, for me, I'm not so sure whether these two cases are connected. In the historic colonial parklands of Virginia, a killer targets couples in their cars at night. One theory is he's posing as a ranger or a cop to dupe his victims.
Step out of the car, sir.
I think it is someone who presents themselves as an authority figure because of the control that's taken place.
I mean, it's easy to get a badge on the internet or in a magazine or at a cop store.
Could be a wannabe cop. You know, someone that couldn't make the grade in law enforcement, couldn't get past the psych test. One thing we know We got a lot of rage here. We've got a lot of rage, a lot of violence. We've got a lot of murders.
Criminal profiler John Kelly thinks the killer's jealous of the young lovers he attacks.
He's angry. He's enraged at it. He can't have that in his life. He's unhappy with his life.
But could there be another reason why he targets couples? Me? I want to hear what Raven thinks.
The couple is an easy prey because the woman will tell the boyfriend to what he has, or how they're hurt. The one wants to protect the other. They're messed up. They're not going to do anything stupid. Look in front of Sam, right?
Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, killed six people and wounded seven in 1976 and 1977. Just like this killer on the Parkway, most of his victims were couples, surprised while sitting in their cars.
The people of the city of New York can rest easy this morning because of the fact that the police have captured a man whom they believe to be the son of Sam.
Son of Sam got caught. But here in Virginia, there would be no resting easy for young lovers on the Parkway. Because in 1988, it happened again. On April 9, 20-year-old Keith Call is at a college party with 18-year-old Cassandra Haley.
He was out on his first date with Cassandra, Sandy, and they had had some classes together.
Keith's big sister, Joyce, remembers the time.
I think that was prom.
She was 26 then, just 6 years older than Keith. But these days, she recalls him as a mother might a son.
He looked happy there.
He did. He was very happy. Loved life.
Keith is studying computer science at college. His whole life ahead of him.
He had a couple girlfriends, but he had had one that he had been dating for like 2 years. And they had broke up like 2 weeks before this happened.
Sandy's the first girl he's asked out since.
She was a very attractive young lady. And she had a lot of friends. She was fun-loving, really cute, you know, young lady, and she had everything going for her, too.
Keith has promised Sandy's parents he'll have her home by 2 a.m. Sometime around 1:30, they leave together. Early the next morning, Keith's dad is on his way to work on the Colonial Parkway.
He saw Keith's car there on the parkway. So he pulled over and he stopped. And the driver's side door was wide open. And the glove box was open. And the keys were in the car. And another thing was that the front seat was pulled forward.
So like somebody smaller than Keith drove that car?
Yes. My dad thought maybe he had just went off with some friends and left his car there, or either they had walked down to the beach. And he said that, you know, that is not like him to do something like that.
In a move he'll come to regret, Keith's dad shakes off his worry and heads on to work. About 2 hours later, a park ranger on his morning patrol reports the car abandoned.
I get a phone call from my mother, and she sounds kind of frantic. And she said, Joy, you gotta meet me down at the parkway. Park rangers called and they said that Keith's car is down there. And so I jump in the car and I'm going across a bridge and I get this terrible feeling in my gut. I don't know what it was. We go down the parkway and I come around the corner and I see this yellow caution tape blocking the entrance to where his car was.
Investigators at the scene find some of Keith and Sandy's clothes in the car. They believe the couple may have gone skinny dipping and drowned.
They were all walking hand in hand, trying to find if there were any bodies in the water.
But something doesn't add up.
Was Keith ever known to go swimming in the York River?
Not when it's 40 degrees and you have to go down a high bluff to get there in the middle of the night, no.
So if they didn't go swimming, what the hell happened?
What was really strange was some of Keith's clothes, his underwear, his watch, his eyeglasses, Cassandra's wallet and a bra and one shoe, they weren't in there when my dad stopped the first time.
So let me get this straight. They were in there when the cops came later?
Yes.
But your father reports that they weren't in there when he stopped.
No, and he would have, that would have freaked him out. That's something he would notice.
Damn right you'd notice. It's the kind of disturbing detail that makes your mind go places you don't want it to go. Tormented by such thoughts, Joyce and her family joined the desperate search for Keith and Sandy.
We're out there looking everywhere and just on adrenaline, you know, running blindly. Whatever we can do that makes us feel like we're doing something to find him, to find her.
A tides expert tells police if the bodies are in the river, it'll take them a few days to surface. And sure enough, 4 days later, they find a body. But it's not Keith or Sandy. It's a middle-aged man who fell off a boat days earlier. Their hopes dashed, the family resumes the search.
Joyce, when did you start to feel that this is a fruitless search? My brother's body's not gonna be found.
Well, it took a while. It took a while before I would really let that enter into my mind. I just had to keep thinking that we're gonna find him.
But despite extensive searches over two decades, Keith and Sandy's remains have never been found.
To watch our parents mourn, I mean, they were devastated. My mother, you know, bless her heart, could barely, you know, come out of his room for a while. We know they're dead, you know, but then you don't even know what happened to them. You don't know where their bodies are, and you don't know what they went through before they were killed. I hope that their remains will be found. I hope they will. I have to have hope. And more than that, I hope that we find who did it so they can be held accountable.
I've got just a one-word answer to that. Amen. But are we looking for one killer for all three couples? What connects them? Who is this guy? And as if we needed any more unanswered questions, what happens next is the most mysterious turn yet. I'm at the York River Overlook on the Colonial Parkway in Virginia, where Keith Call's vehicle was found abandoned on April 10, 1988. But what we know is the last time Keith Call and Cassandra Haley were seen was at a party, but their vehicle
was found parked right up there, the door open, wallet out, window half down. What does that say?
Like the first two couples killed, looks like maybe Keith and Sandy were also pulled over or asked to show ID.
My license, I don't know what's going on.
It fits the theory that the Parkway killer could be posing as a cop or a ranger. I want to see what Raven thinks.
It'd be very easy to sell on a normal John Jane Doe driving down the road thinking they got pulled up by a cop. I mean, it's not naive. When you see someone's lights on the back, you assume right off the back that it's a cop.
Raven agrees. It's a credible scenario for all three of the cases. But with Keith and Sandy, it ends differently. Their bodies are never found.
We killers, we drive around and we find a place to show the body. In this case, the killer might very well have taken enough time to bury him, and they may be there right in plain sight and nobody sees them. I found sometimes the best place to do it is out in the open in an open field with just a shallow grave. There's a lot of luck involved in finding something that someone wants to put away and not be found.
Is it really just luck? Or is the Parkway killer getting smarter with each victim? Police would have to wait more than a year to find out. On September 5, 1989, in Amelia County, Virginia, 21-year-old Dan Lauer loads the trunk of his car.
You ready to go?
Yep, got the essentials.
With him is 18-year-old Anna Phelps, the girlfriend of Dan's older brother, Clinton. After a lot of coaxing, Anna and Clinton have convinced Dan to come live with them in Virginia Beach.
Roachcliffe, like I said, the essentials.
Earlier that night, Anna had shared a secret with her other brother, William.
She pulled me aside and was telling me that, hey, Clinton and I were thinking about getting married. And she was asking me what I thought of that, and I told her, I said, if it makes you happy, that's all that matters.
Dan is moving away from his parents for the first time. Anna is about to get hitched. They're excited and optimistic as they hit the road around 11 p.m.
I was on the phone to my buddy.
It's 150 miles east to Virginia Beach.
Okay, I'm not giving you this.
And into the thrilling unknown of new beginnings. They play music, chat, and laugh. Never imagining the terrible fate that awaits them. As I drive that same stretch of road myself, Interstate 64, I imagine how Dan must have felt. He's driving down the road, out of the nest. He's heading into this new life to live with his brother and his brother's girlfriend. He's got all his belongings in the car, cassette tapes, books, all his clothes, stuff. The world is just this, it's opened up to him, endless possibilities. But there's something following behind him, and he doesn't even realize it. Darkness, evil. It's shadowing Dan, and he's about to run into it. Early the next day, Anna's mom gets the first bad omen. Anna hasn't called to say they arrived in Virginia Beach.
When are you expecting to hear from her again?
At least the next day. She called Mom all the time, every day.
And what happens?
Red flags went up. Mom called the police.
Hours later, another bad sign. Dan's car is found, but there's no sign of Dan or Anna.
We knew something was up. They found the car. They're not around. She hasn't called. Something's going on.
The car's location only deepens the mystery.
We get reports that the car is found on the westbound side, but they're headed east.
The car's at a rest stop in New Kent County, barely 60 miles from where they set off. And why is it on the wrong side of the road?
And what do they find inside the car?
Everything that they had, all their belongings, and all their stuff was in there. Her purse was in the car, money was in the car.
But there's a curious item missing, a woolen blanket of Dan's. Plus, another tantalizing clue. A roach clip belonging to Anna was left hanging on the window, almost like it had been carefully placed there. A search is launched.
Immediately when they found the car, they had the dogs out looking for them.
But there's no sign of Anna or Dan. 6 long weeks pass, and still nothing. And then, 2 hunters are walking an old logging road, about 3 miles from the rest stop, and the family's worst fears are realized.
They had found the remains, and I was just in total shock. And I don't know how long I was there with just, you know, basically my mouth open. I was in shock. I couldn't believe it. And my cousin happened to be there, and he just, you know, he just put his arm around me. As soon as he did, I just broke down and just cried. This can't be real. This is not happening.
The bodies are covered with Dan's missing blanket. A forensic team examines every leaf, every grain of soil, hunting for clues to the killer. They find blood spatter and pieces of Anna's fingernails, and signs that the actual murder location was back down the logging road. Weeds on the undercarriage of Dan's car match vegetation near the murder site, suggesting the killer used the car to dump the bodies and then abandoned it back at the rest area. It could explain why the vehicle was left in the westbound rest stop. Everything a killer does tells us something about who he is. Every decision is driven by his personality. Raven knows this all too well. So I want to ask him, why did the killer of Dan Lauer and Anna Phelps take them so deep into the woods?
He may not be familiar with those woods, but he probably feels very comfortable in the woods. He knows once they get 50 feet off the roadway, nobody's going to see what's going on. A hunter would do that normally.
Well, the victims they found in the woods were just kind of dumped. Why wouldn't he bury them? Why didn't you bury your victims?
Well, I felt buried. You're spending too much time with the bodies. Even though you're in a secluded area, you still have to deal with the unknown. You might be familiar with the woods, but you may not be familiar with who lived in the woods. I remember a case where a guy took this woman out into the hills, and he set the body on fire, thinking, oh, we ought to get rid of the body. But little did he know that this fire could be seen by 10 miles away, and they called the fire department, and he was immediately apprehended. Had he not spent the time to burn the body, he would have probably got away with it. So why spend all that extra time with the body when he could just dump the body and leave? And everyone that comes in contact with this body between you and it becomes a suspect before you are.
Dan's remains are too decomposed to determine the cause of death, but an autopsy reveals Anna was stabbed.
What do you miss most about Anna?
There's so many things. I mean, just her presence, because she walked into a room, she would light it up. I mean, she was very funny. The jokes, the comical stuff that she would do, make you laugh.
Boy, this case, it's starting to take its toll on me.
For Dan and Anna, the world was full of hope and possibilities. Horizons stretching out before them. And then, terror, darkness. But at least, after their tragic deaths, the Colonial Parkway murders stopped. Or did they? 4 double homicides over 3 years. They call them the Colonial Parkway murders. Are they the work of one diabolical serial killer? Someone posing as a cop or ranger? Prowling Lover's Lane. Creeping up on couples when they least expect it.
Step out of the car, sir. You too, ma'am.
What seems to be the problem, officer?
I said step out of the car.
It's a storyline fit for Hollywood. But is the truth more complicated?
When I went out there, what I noticed was they weren't as close together, these murders, as I had originally thought. Does that make a difference for you?
You know, it does and it doesn't. I mean, we do have some distance there, but we know this is kind of a pretty rural area, too.
Sure.
So there is some traveling that needs to take place.
Sure.
We know that serial killers will troll for miles and miles to find the victim or victims of choice. So that really doesn't play a big, big role with me as far as me believing that they're not connected. I have to believe they are connected.
I'm heading back to where it all started, where the first victims were found, to meet again with former homicide detective turned private investigator, Steve Spingola. He knows these cases better than most. So what's his take?
Are these cases connected?
I don't think that they are. I don't think they're related. There has been a large number of investigative resources placed into these cases. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to find any DNA evidence that links all of the cases, much less any two of the cases in any of the examinations that we've conducted.
And there's the problem. These cases seem so similar, but without hard evidence, we can't know for sure if they're all the work of one killer, let alone catch him. But Spingola's optimistic because there's another case, not normally grouped in the Parkway murders, that could provide a break. May 1996, Shenandoah National Park, west of Richmond, Virginia. 24-year-old Julie Williams and 26-year-old Lolly Winans are camping along the Southern Appalachian Trail. The trip is a dream come true for a young couple in love. A chance to be alone in the Virginia wilderness.
They had taken off a couple of weeks from work, and they were actually going to be hiking throughout the park. They were out of contact with friends and relatives, no cell phone, no internet.
But they're not alone. Someone is stalking them. And their happiness, their love, and their lives are about to be destroyed.
Their bodies were recovered near the Skyline Lodge in the park. Both had been stabbed in the neck, their throats slit. No signs of sexual assault, no signs of robbery.
It seems their killer didn't want sex or money. So what was the motive? Spingola thinks it's a hate crime.
You're sick. You disgust me.
Just like the murders of Kathy Thomas and Becky Dowski.
They seem similar.
They are. The wounds are very similar. They're both cut from left to the right, deep wounds.
Julie and Lolly were bound with ligatures and had their throats slit, the same as Kathy and Becky.
I clearly think the Thomas, Dowski,
and Williams Winans' homicides are related because of the injuries, because of the similar MOs of the perpetrator.
So I love Steve Spingola's theory about the connection. Thomas, Dowski, Winans, Williams. It makes sense to me. What makes sense is that a serial killer leaves a signature. And there's definitely a signature in those two cases that could possibly connect them. I like that.
Recently, the FBI met personally with the victims' families and made a promise to retest evidence and start a top-to-bottom review of all the cases. For families who have been waiting years for answers, it wasn't a moment too soon.
I'm more hopeful now than I've ever been before, because after the FBI began putting resources back into the case, we've actually made some progress.
With new life in the investigation, we can start to find the truth amongst the theories. Is it one guy posing as a cop? A maniac who hates lesbians? Or any couple in love? Or are there several killers out there?
I've been thinking about the connections in this Colonial Parkway case. I've spoken to the families. They don't care if it's a serial killer or not. They just want justice. They want closure. They want the pain to go away.
All the family members want to find out what happened to their loved ones. And, you know, how do you just give up? You can't. They're our flesh and blood.
These were 10 people in our society that could have been future leaders, good students. I mean, from the Naval Academy, people that protected the land you and I are standing on right now, and they're murdered. And we aren't able to go out and solve those. That just bothers me, because these families, when you listen to them and they cry 25 years later, the tears are just as real now as they were 25 years ago.
You just learn to deal with it. You learn to accept it. But the thing was, she was... It's just hard to deal with sometimes, because you think about all the, you know, the fun times you had, you know, just a lot of the fun things, and then all of a sudden you come down to the truth that, you know, she's not around anymore. Somebody took her from you, and they're walking around free. You know, they killed her and got away with it.
For the victim's sake, and so their families can get some justice.